you're wanting to give to someone the most important thing, you probably might want to save it for last. If you have, let's say, a speech you need to present or something important you need to tell someone, you might just save the most important thing for the very end. And for Mary, I think this is possibly the case. From the beginning, remember, she's been telling us that from her own heart is overflowing a song of praise, a song that magnifies God, that makes him look big to the world. That's her whole purpose in this song. She wants Luke, the writer, the recorder of this song, and everyone else who is ever going to read this to know of what God has done for her. Just a lowly Jewish girl in a no-name town called Nazareth. She wanted people to know what God did in her life. And she magnifies God's attributes. She magnifies all of the things he's going to do because of the birth of this child that has been conceived in her womb. And now at the very end, she saves perhaps the most critical truth. And the way I'm going to couch it for us is that it's the big picture. It's what Mary has been driving toward. It's what she ultimately wants us to see. But before we get there, I want you to imagine something with me. Kids are good at imagining things, and adults, sometimes we leave our imagination back in childhood. But let's bring our imagination back for right here, right now, at 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning. Imagine that you are the boss of your workplace. Doesn't matter where you work. Imagine you're the manager of the office or the foreman of the construction site. Imagine you're the chief surgeon at your hospital or the superintendent of your school district. Whatever it looks like for you in your workplace, imagine you're the boss. You're the person in charge. And as the person in charge, imagine that you could delegate work responsibilities to all your employees. Imagine that you are the person in charge of divvying out the salary, the benefits, and determining all of that. Imagine that you were in charge of settling all of the disputes that go on between employees in any workplace. And you can continue to imagine, but the idea is you're in charge of a lot of stuff. Now imagine you told all the people under you that as long as they showed up on time and they did their work well, you would guarantee that they would continue to have a competitive salary, competitive benefits, along with opportunities for advancing in the workplace. That sounds like a pretty nice situation. I'd want to work for a boss like that. But imagine, though, that all the people working under you, they were initially grateful for all you did for them, all the promises you made, and they were really thankful that you did that for them. They respected your authority at first. But as time passed, something changed. They became resentful of your position. And that resentment didn't arise out of your poor leadership skills. It didn't arise because of some kind of unsafe working conditions, nothing like that. It was just because they didn't want someone else to be in charge of them. They were sick and tired of someone else bossing them around, telling them what they should be doing. So they rebelled. Now imagine if they tried in their rebellion, quote unquote, to manage the workplace on their own, settle disputes by themselves, maintain their salaries and benefits, all without your help or the company's intervention at all. Imagine they tried to do all the things we do in a workplace and all the benefits we receive, the remuneration that is given to us. Imagine trying to maintain that without OSHA, without someone in charge, without a supervisor, without anything like that. They tried to do it all on their own. Imagine that in this rebellion of theirs, they openly aired their grievances to each other while they were on the clock. Imagine that they even talked about quitting this job and going someplace else right in front of you. They talked about it openly, and they didn't care if you were within earshot or not. Now, needless to say, every attempt of these employees to manage themselves or to look for other employment ultimately ended in failure. Now, I've given you this imagined scenario. Let me ask you a question. How would you respond if you were the boss over these kinds of people? most of us probably wouldn't take too kindly to that. There would be some people who would not have jobs anymore. Lots of people, probably. Most of us probably wouldn't wait for these employees to just settle down, wait for this to blow over, wait for them to just realize how wrong they are and go back to the way things were. Most of us wouldn't do that. Most of us wouldn't have that kind of patience. You might even strongly consider abandoning this job, resigning, because the people that you're working that are working for you obviously aren't fit to rule. They obviously have no interest in submitting to your authority, in doing the work that they're supposed to be doing, none of that. That would be a frustrating work situation for sure. Now, when God, the God of heaven, chose a nation to be his own, do you know that he did not choose the most ideal people? Like the employees in our imagined workplace, the nation of Israel rebelled against God's authority and his righteous laws. Their rebellion wasn't motivated by God's poor leadership. He's a good person to be in charge, the best, in fact. Their rebellion was not motivated because he had unreasonable demands. No, their rebellion was motivated by the wickedness of the human heart. It was motivated by that natural sinful desire to want more than the good things that God gives to us. Now, over the course of this 2,000-year-long relationship between God and Israel, and I'm speaking from Mary's perspective, from Mary's point of view, living in, you know, the first century, Israel and God only had a relationship for 2,000 years. I say only, but that's a long time. Over that course of time, he had multiple opportunities to abandon them and to start all over. From the birth of the nation through Abraham until the time of Christ, the Jewish people repeatedly made known to God that they had no interest in obedience, they had no interest in submission or allegiance to his law or his covenant. They failed to live up to the calling that Yahweh had given them. They were supposed to be a special people, a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. They were supposed to share his goodness and his glory with the world, but they didn't do that. Instead, they rejected him and they turned to the false gods of other nations. And that decision to do that repeatedly, not just once, but over and over again throughout their history, cost them the land that God gave to them. It cost them their freedom and their national sovereignty. A big price to pay in order to just rule yourself. But do you know that God, in spite of all of that, still showed mercy to his covenant people? Even their worship of false gods could not dissuade him from keeping his covenant to them. Mary, as a Jewish girl, understood the depth of God's commitment to his people. She had such faith in the genuineness of his promises that when she discovers Israel's Messiah has been conceived inside of her womb, she praised God. Why? Because, as verse 54 says, he has helped his servant Israel. You see, what she realized is that her pregnancy had national implications. There's going to be a bigger effect than just her life being changed. When a family has a child, we have one family at least here that just recently had a baby, right? Life changes when you have a new infant born into the world. No doubt Mary and Joseph's life was going to change because they were going to have their first child. But that birth would also have implications for the entire Jewish people. Jesus' birth wouldn't just signal the end of all injustice against the people of God. We learned that last week. But it would also do something very important for the people of Israel. It would serve as God's final proof of faithfulness to his nation. The final proof of faithfulness. In our sermon series on Mary's song, we've seen so far how she places God's glory underneath the microscope for us to examine and explore in all of its brilliance, all of its glory, all of its majesty. And we've seen all throughout this song how Mary lifts up God and makes him look great. But as we study the final words of her song, we're going to discover she will unfold for us the big picture of what has been going on throughout history, how God has been dealing with his people, and how that now culminates in the birth of Jesus Christ. And what's beautiful is that he has not only disclosed these purposes to Israel, but he was also faithful to fulfill every word of his covenant to them. We're going to take a look at that here in short order. Now, the relationship between God and Israel, where did that even start? Well, there's two critical events to know in order to know where this relationship began. The first was God's call of Abraham. You may be familiar with this. Back in Genesis 12, God set apart Abraham and his offspring. What did he tell him? Well, this is just a portion of it, but he told Abraham, I'm going to make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. You shall be a blessing, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. What is God exactly promising here? What are the delineations of this covenant? What's included? Well, number one, he's giving them a plot of land to live in, a physical territory, a geographic portion of earth to live on. He told Abraham, go out of your own country where your family's from, and I'm going to lead you to a land where you're going to live and what your seed will inherit. He also tells them that he's going to increase Abraham's population, the nation that he's going to be birthing, but also he will give a great reputation to this nation. He will make you your name great. And finally, he will make this nation a source of blessing for the whole world. So this is the first critical moment in when God begins his relationship with Israel, is when he calls Abraham, the father of the nation. The second key event that establishes this connection between God and Israel is, I'm going to call it a combined event, is when he delivers Israel out of Egypt and when he institutes the Mosaic Law. Now, most Christians would probably consider these to be two separate events. And essentially, time-wise, they are. They happen at two different times. The Exodus happens at one time in history, and just a short time later, God gives the Mosaic Law. But in the Jewish mind, and really even, I would even say in God's mind, this is all one event. Because what God is trying to establish for us is that these two events together, the Exodus and the giving of Moses' law, were a way for God to demonstrate that these people are my own. Because I didn't only rescue them, I brought them to myself. I made an exclusive relationship with them. And that's why we can see these things together. So after the children of Israel cross the Red Sea and they make it safely to Mount Sinai, God initiates his covenant with them by reminding them of what he had just done. Exodus 19 is the chapter just before Exodus 20, when God gives the Ten Commandments, and he starts giving out the law. What does he say prior to giving the conditions of that covenant? Well, he tells them in Exodus 19, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians. You just saw. I opened up the Red Sea for you, let you pass, and then I crushed the Egyptian army. I would say he's probably also including in that the 10 plagues of Egypt before they even left. But he says, you've seen what I did to them. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people. For all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. When God rescued Israel, he didn't free them and then abandon them to their own whims. He didn't say, okay, now you're free. Use whatever freedom you have for yourself and for your own purposes. No. He says, I made you free to bring you to myself, to start a relationship with you, to make you a special treasure, a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. What do all these titles that God gives to Israel tell us? It tells us that he wanted a special, loving relationship with this country, with this people. They would be his ambassadors to the world, to reflect his holy character. Just like when you and your spouse on your wedding day made a mutual decision to love each other exclusively. That's what God did in the Exodus and in the giving of the law. He started an exclusive love relationship with the people of Israel. He made a sacred commitment to them. Now, as part of that covenant, the children of Israel were also bound to worship him and serve him alone. That's why the nation is often called, you look through the Old Testament, the nation of Israel is often called God's servant. And that's what Mary says. He has helped his servant Israel. It doesn't happen terribly often in the Bible, but David is the first reference I could find to when this idea of Israel being a servant is mentioned in the Old Testament scriptures. He mentions it in a song when the Ark of the Covenant is being brought back to Jerusalem when he is king. This idea, this theme of Israel as God's servant is especially a part of the prophecy of Isaiah. And we can see this in Isaiah 41, verses 8 and 9. The prophet writes for us, this is God speaking, but Isaiah recording for us, "But you, O Israel, are my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the descendants of Abraham, my friend. You, whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called from its farthest regions and said to you, you are my servant. I have chosen you and have not cast you away." What did it mean to be Yahweh's servant, to be the servant of God? Well, the nation had a special responsibility to do his bidding. He started that relationship, but they also had a side to it. They also had obligations, and part of that was that they would serve him and worship him. But another important aspect of that responsibility to be a servant of God is that the nation would be specially selected to put God's goodness and glory on full display for the world to see. The problem was, Israel failed to do this. This was their obligation, to make manifest the glory of God to the Gentile nations, and they couldn't do it. From the very beginning, from the inception of Israel, the people worshipped idols. They lacked faith in God's provision for them when they were in the wilderness. And that pattern continued through the times of the judges, through the dynasties of the kings, through the ministries of the prophets. They were unfaithful to the covenant God had given them. God allowed that to continue until finally he judged them. He took them out of their own land and he made them captives of a foreign nation. Now, Mary knew the history of her people. She understood all of this. As we've read this song, we know she knew her Old Testament pretty well. And one thing she would have known for sure is what her people have been through. All the suffering they've had, all the injustices against them, but also their disobedience, their disloyalty to God, their lack of allegiance to him and his covenant. They had failed to live up to their calling as God's servant. But do you know that Mary also had confidence in the character of God? She knew that God would never abandon his nation, he would never forsake them, he would never cast them away. She was convinced of that. In fact, she knew it so well that she's praising God because the Messiah has been sent. The Messiah is already in the world and he's getting ready to be born. And he would bring redemption to God's wayward people. Though Jesus' birth had not yet occurred, her song is looking forward to that spiritual help that God is going to provide to his chosen nation. Now, I don't know that Mary realized all that her son was going to do in order to help Israel. Help is a pretty generic word. But in order to help Israel, her son would have to die. And I believe it's Simeon in the temple who ends up telling her, giving her the bad news, that you are going to sorrow because of what your son is going to experience. So she doesn't quite know yet what's going to happen. I don't know what she knew at this point in terms of Jesus' coming death and resurrection. But at the very least, she knew that the son I'm going to give birth to is going to help my nation. He's going to save, rescue, deliver my people. And she looks forward to that. She definitely understood the relationship between God and his servant. And that relationship serves as a backdrop for her own story, for what she's experiencing. The baby she would give birth to was the Son of God, given by God as a gift to her people. His birth would be God's final act of love in a commitment to his covenant, in the greater story of his faithfulness to Israel. Now, I want to stick with this idea of the story between God and Israel. Mary traces the story of this relationship back to the very beginning. In doing so, she's also going to tell us what are God's motivations in this story. You read any good story, any good novel or book, what you find is that the main characters have certain motivations, right? They have goals, they have purposes that are driving their own actions, and they usually push the plot forward. They kind of help the story move along. If nobody has motivations, it's kind of a boring story. And often what happens is when two opposing characters have two opposing motivations, two opposing goals and visions for what's supposed to happen, that leads up to the main conflict of the story. That brings it up to the boiling point, right? Well, in the Old Testament story of Yahweh and Israel, we see their initial motivations. What did they start with? Well, God always loved his people and wanted the best for them. He wanted to bless them. From the start, that's what he wanted. That was his motivation. And he demonstrates that by giving them his righteous laws, by promising to protect them and to provide for them. Now, Israel, on the other hand, initially, they were interested in that. They were fine with God's promises of protection and provision. But what happened? Their motivations changed. Suddenly, they weren't so concerned with pleasing the God of their nation. Instead, they turned to other gods. Instead, they sought after the wicked desires of their heart. And that led to a form of national punishment in captivity through Babylon and Assyria. Now, in a typical story, when a character has bad motivations, when they're the bad guy in the story, typically through the plot of the story, those bad motivations get unmasked. The bad guy is defeated, right? He's taken out. He's shown for what he really is. Well, in the story of God and Israel, it's a little different. You see, because even though Israel had bad motivations, they stopped loving God, they stopped worshiping and serving God, God was never out to defeat his people. He was never out to get them back. You see, because God's not motivated by vengeance or by justice. He is a just God, but that wasn't his main motivation. Instead, Mary tells us what his motivation is. He's motivated by his chesed love. She tells us in this verse, verse 54, he has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of what? His mercy. That's already shown up. She's already sung about and praised God for his loyal, faithful, covenant love to his people. And now she's bringing it up again because it's important in the story of Israel and God. That's why God loves these people so much, not because of anything they have done. If anything, they have shown they don't deserve God's love. But that doesn't matter to God because he is motivated by this loyal love to his people. So Mary, in her song, magnifies the Lord because he remembered his mercy. That's why he wants to help them. Now, Mary's song also tells us something else. It tells us that God's mercy, this covenant loyalty to his people, is rooted in the history of the nation. She tells us about how God remembered his mercy to Abraham and to his seed. So God first demonstrated this covenant loyalty to one man, the father of the nation, Abraham, and to his descendants. He made certain unconditional promises to Abraham and his family. And throughout the Old Testament, God never forgot those promises. He kept them intact. In fact, you read early on in the story of Israel, even through the Pentateuch, through the first five books of Moses, you find that there were several occasions on which God tells his people, I haven't forgotten you. I'm remembering you. And I'm remembering the covenant I made with your ancestor, Abraham. One of the critical ones that you can find in Exodus 2 is when God is getting ready to send Moses to lead the nation out of Egypt. And what do we find? Well, we find the birth account first of Moses and how he's picked up by the Egyptian princess and that whole story. And then by chapter 2, we already see Moses growing up into a man. He runs away into Midian, and all those things happen. But we find that the Egyptian king dies, the one who had put them under slavery, right? Put the nation under slavery. And what does God say? Well, the children of Israel were groaning because of their bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of the bondage. So God heard their groaning. And what else? He remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. That's what motivated him to get his people out of that land, because he remembered his covenant. Now we go to a more sinister example, a time where Israel was in total rebellion, total disobedience. We all remember the golden calf incident, where Moses is coming down out of the mountain, ready to present the law, and what does he find? The people are worshiping an idol. The nation hasn't existed for but a few weeks, months, and already they have rebelled. Already they've gone against the Lord. And Moses begs for the people that God would not destroy them, because God told him, Moses, let me start over. I'll start over with you and your family. Let me get rid of these people because they clearly have no interest in serving me. But Moses, in his prayer, I don't have the whole prayer recorded here, but you can look at it in Exodus 32. In verse 13, he pleads with the Lord in his prayer, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self. God made a promise to these individuals and their descendants. He said, I'm never going to cast you off. And so what does God do? He relented from the harm which he said he would do to his people. That is amazing, that a man of God could stand in the gap, could pray in that situation, and it all changes. But you see, it wasn't because God was some angry bully who needed to be appeased. No, no, no. All that time, God intended to show mercy. I believe that. God is always a God of mercy. And it took a man like Moses to be there at the right place at the right time and to, from our standpoint, remind God, God, you made a covenant with your people. Don't forget it. And he didn't. He relented from the harm he would do to them. His commitment to his covenant also gave the nation an important guarantee. If you look through the law of Moses, you find that there are several occasions where God promises national blessing for the people if they obey. So as long as they continue to keep the covenant, as long as they continue to obey the laws of Moses, God would bless them. He'd give them bountiful crops. He'd give them many children. He'd give them prosperity in war, in their economy, all these blessings he promises to them. But then on the flip side, he says, if you disobey me, and if you are disloyal to my covenant, then I will do the opposite. My hand will be against you, essentially. You're not going to win in war. You're not going to have a prosperous economy. You will not have bountiful harvests. You won't have any of that. In fact, it'll be pretty severe punishment and judgment that I will bring upon you. But even if the nation got so bad and was so ensconced in their rebellion that they would not, essentially they wouldn't turn back to God, God says that even in that case, he would not forget them. Because he puts forward the olive branch to them and says, if you will confess your sin, if you will humble yourselves, and if you will come back to me, then I will gladly restore you. I will gladly remember my covenant with you. And this is what he says in Leviticus 26. He says, when they are in the land of their enemies, when they've been taken captive by another nation, I won't cast them out. I won't cast them away, nor shall I abhor them to utterly destroy them and break my covenant with them. For I am the Lord their God, but for their sake, I will remember the covenant of their ancestors. No matter how bad Israel got, God would remember what he promised to them. His commitment to his covenant was not based on how faithful the people were. His commitment to his covenant was based on his own faithfulness. Now, finally, we see that Mary's song points us to the hope of Messiah's coming. All throughout the Old Testament, God was dropping hints that he was sending someone, a deliverer, a redeemer. Many of us obviously think of the prophecies of Christ's birth. Those are God's clues for us, right? The problem is that many Jewish people in the Old Testament, and even in Mary's day, they wouldn't have seen it quite the same way. Because you see, those clues, kind of like in a mystery novel, when the author drops clues, he's not trying to give away the whole plot to you. He's giving you enough so that you can start to pick up the pieces a little bit. And then by the end, it's the big reveal. And you can see, ah, now it makes sense. Now all the clues fit together. Now the puzzle pieces are starting to match. That's essentially what the messianic prophecies are for Jewish people at this time. They're not seeing the picture quite like we have, because as long as many of us have been believers, we've probably heard about messianic prophecies and how Jesus was going to come, and it was recorded in the Old Testament. We have that benefit. They really didn't. The clues weren't quite as clear. And people debate when God revealed the first one. When did he first drop a clue about who he was going to send? Well, I want to start where Mary ends in her song. Because what does she say? She says, he has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy as he spoke to our fathers, to Abraham and his seed forever. So apparently Mary believed that whatever God was about to do in sending the Messiah through her, he had already spoken about this. This wasn't brand new information. And the first person she mentions, of course, is Abraham, and God remembering his covenant to that man and his family. Remember how in that covenant we find this clue, this statement, this promise of God: in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Okay, now, reading that on the surface, I probably wouldn't get Messiah out of that. I probably wouldn't understand that to mean God's going to send someone who's going to die on a cross and pay for my sins and rise again. I don't get all of that information. Abraham didn't. There's no way you could have, right? But Paul connects the dots for us in Galatians when he teaches us that the gospel message, including Messiah's coming, was first preached to Abraham. He says the scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel to Abraham beforehand. In what verse, in what passage did he say this? In the first covenant to him. In you, all the nations shall be blessed. So though he knew almost none of the details, Abraham was given a glimpse of what God was about to do. And in Mary's song, Abraham is the representative of the first time God drops a clue for his people about Messiah. God continues to drop clues throughout the Old Testament scriptures. You could look at the Psalms, the prophets. We won't have time to go through all of those today. You're probably familiar with many of them. But these prophecies point in some way to a coming deliverer, to someone who would redeem Israel. Mary reflects this truth in verse 55 when she says, as he spoke to our fathers. Again, this was already said. God talked about this. She had an expectation of Messiah's coming. What she didn't know was that she would get involved in this whole thing. And that was the special part for her. Now, the purpose of this closing line to the song, what we're studying today, is that Christ's birth is kind of a forecast of what God would do to help his chosen covenant people. We saw this last week from Pastor Thomas's message about how Mary is looking forward to how the birth of her son is going to get rid of injustice against God's people. Had that happened already? No, of course not. Israel was still under Roman rule, and nothing had changed. She was just pregnant now. But nothing tangibly had changed. Well, she's looking forward in her song to what God's going to do when her son finally gets to do what he's been chosen to do as the Messiah. And in this case, she's looking at the covenant of God the same way. Messiah has not quite come yet. He hasn't been born. He hasn't done his job yet, but he's about to. And she's excited for that. She's praising God for what he's going to do. It's really one of the great things he has done for her and for her people. Just like he ends injustice to his people by showing his strength or by scattering the proud, by removing people from their thrones, so he has shown his faithfulness to Israel by remembering his covenant mercy. One last point I'll make about Mary's song, and then we'll make some applications for us. This has all been about Israel so far, but it does apply to us, and it does have meaning for us today. God will also faithfully keep and fulfill his covenant to Abraham and his descendants forever. That word forever is critical, because there are plenty of theologians and Bible teachers out there who would tell you that because of Israel's disobedience and rebellion against God, God has actually cast them off, and they're not really his people anymore. He has forsaken them, essentially, because they forsook him. They believe that he won't fulfill the promises of his covenant literally. They might have meaning for the church today or, you know, for other groups, but not really for Israel. The problem is this thinking goes against everything that Yahweh promises to Israel. You see, the covenant he made to Abraham and his seed wasn't a conditional promise. His promise was not, if you do X, I will do Y. His promise was, Abraham, here are my blessings to you and to all the future generations that come out of you. No conditions whatsoever. The blessings are yours. And again, not because Abraham did anything special, but simply because God loved this man and the nation that would come out of him. He made this clear multiple times to the nation that the fulfillment of his covenant didn't depend on how the nation behaved, but simply on the grounds of his own faithfulness. At the end of Moses' life, in the book of Deuteronomy, we find that Moses is instructing the new generation of Israelites about heading into the promised land. He's reminding them of the Mosaic covenant. And he tells them why Yahweh chose them in the first place. It's probably not for the reason we all would think. The Lord didn't set his love on you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any other people, for you were the least of all peoples, but because the Lord loves you, and because he would keep the oath which he swore to you. God chose them because he loved them, and he's going to keep his covenant to them because he loves them. It's as simple as that. I'll end here with the prophet Jeremiah telling the nation hundreds of years later, after Moses, how committed Yahweh was to his chosen people. God wouldn't cast off Israel for any reason. And Jeremiah gives us some reasons, as an imagined scenario, for why God would cast off his people. Notice what he says in Jeremiah 31, 35, and 36. Thus says the Lord, who gives the sun for the light by day, the ordinances of the moon and the stars for a light by night. If those ordinances depart from me, says the Lord, then the seed of Israel shall also cease from being a nation before me forever. So in other words, if the order of the cosmos gets disrupted, if the sun, moon, and stars stop doing their job in the solar system, only at that point would God cast off Israel and they would cease to be his people. And just to further the point even more, Jeremiah tells us in the very next verse, if heaven above can be measured and the foundations of the earth searched out beneath, I will also cast off all the seed of Israel for all that they have done, says the Lord. In other words, if anyone in the world could discover and measure out all of space and all of the earth that is beneath your feet, if you can do that, then I will cast off Israel forever. What is Jeremiah saying by this? Well, in modern verbiage, He's telling us that God will cast off Israel when pigs fly. In other words, it's never going to happen. It's not going to happen. His covenant promises to them remain intact, and they are going to be fulfilled to the letter, just like he said. Now, as we've explored the story here so far of Yahweh's relationship with Israel, we're left with a burning question. What does this have to do with me? If I'm not a Jewish person, if I have no Jewish blood in me, then do these promises matter to me at all? It seems to affect me very little. But as Paul tells us in his letters, the things that were written before in the Old Testament were written for our learning. So God has something to tell us through this special relationship of love he had with his chosen nation. And I want to draw out for us two important lessons as we reflect on the conclusion of Mary's song. Number one, we should magnify God by observing the bigger picture of his plan. I think as we've read this so far, and if you know anything about the character of Mary, again, the Bible doesn't give us a full description of her. We don't have books written about Mary. But the little bit that we know about her, it's easy to tell. She was not a shallow person. She had a personal and a spiritual depth to her life. Very special individual for sure. And no doubt that's partly why God chose her for the task of bringing his son into the world. In her song, she demonstrates her understanding that the virgin birth wasn't just a miracle for her. She demonstrates that this miracle would impact generations of God's people to come. This miracle would eventually rescue God's people from oppression, from injustice, from dispossession. All of those things would take place. This miracle would also demonstrate God's faithfulness to his chosen nation. Mary believed that, and she had the wisdom to see that story in the light of her own story, in the light of her own experiences. In our lives, it's easy to view the trials and the triumphs that we have, also the victories and the blessings we experience, but to see them through just our own lens, to not look at the bigger scope of what God is doing. I think it would be comparable to taking a giant observatory telescope like this and using that to view the Manhattan skyline. Now, that would be cool. No doubt you'd have a really nice view of the city, and you might even see the ant people over across the water, and you know that would be nice to see. But that's not what that's for. That can give you magnification into the farthest reaches of space to see planets and stars, things way beyond the skyline of a city. And I think that's kind of what we do sometimes with our own lives, our own experiences. We're looking at just the smallest portion of what I'm going through and what I'm experiencing, and we forget the bigger picture. We forget to scope out a little bit and see, you know what, God's doing something much greater here. We must learn to view the challenges God gives us, as well as his victories, in light of what he's doing in his kingdom. So in other words, the temporary suffering you go through for the sake of the gospel, or the pain you feel in the midst of a really difficult trial, that's not an insignificant thing in God's plan. He's using that for something bigger, for something greater. He's using those things to refine you and to prune you so that you're better equipped to serve him. So no matter what you endure, good and bad, God is using those experiences to shape what he is doing in our world and to accomplish his purposes. And then you can step back and let the complexity and the awesomeness of God's plan inspire awe and wonder in your own heart. And you can magnify God as Mary did. The last lesson we can take from this is that just as God was faithful to Israel, so he will be faithful to his church. Now, when we see God's faithfulness on display in Scripture, that should encourage us. We should take comfort, because if God was faithful to a people back then, even hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, he will be faithful to me today. Because those promises and the character of God, they last till today. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. So when you read about those examples of God being faithful to his chosen people, to those who follow him, to those who speak for him, take comfort from those examples, because they're all throughout the Old and New Testament. In the case of Israel, however, there's a special relationship that was created, right? And that relationship is exclusive. He didn't make a relationship with any other nation on earth, just Israel, just that ethnic people. The reason he is faithful to a people who have disobeyed and rejected him repeatedly throughout history is because of his covenant with the nation's father, Abraham. And he will stick to that promise no matter what. Now, the miracle of the virgin birth was the final proof of God's faithfulness to his covenant. Obviously, that was the truth on Mary's heart. As she was finishing this song, as she's concluding this psalm of praise, that's what was on her lips: the faithfulness of my God to Israel. All her life, which wasn't long, by the way, she would have been probably 14 or 15 years old at this point. All her life, she had heard about this covenant that Yahweh had made with her Jewish ancestors. She knew the stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Those things were very familiar to her. But she, like the Jewish community around her, had no idea about how that covenant would be fulfilled, how it would come to pass. But the angel's announcement to her about her pregnancy settled the issue for her. Once she heard what God was about to do in her life and for her people, for the world, the issue was settled for her completely. God's keeping this covenant. It's going to happen, and I don't have to worry about it. As we're reflecting on this song about a Jewish girl in Nazareth, we should take heart at the faithfulness of God to all his believing people, not just the ethnic Jewish race, but anyone who is his faithful follower, anyone who is pledged, essentially in their heart, allegiance to him. Remember, though, that the person writing this song down, Luke, a Gentile doctor, is hearing and recording the words of Mary, a Jew. He's hearing this part of her song, and I'm sure he understands. I mean, enough was going on at that point. He understands. This covenant isn't directed toward me. The song of this covenant that she's talking about, that's not directed for me or any Gentile people. But it didn't matter, because though Luke was not Jewish, he was part of the church of God. He was part of God's believing family. And for him, that's all he needed to know, because just as God would faithfully keep his promises to Israel, he would faithfully protect and enable his church to accomplish its mission, to do what it was supposed to do. Now, let me be clear. God hasn't made the same promises to Israel that he made to the church. They're separate entities. But he has guaranteed that he is going to build the church. And not even the councils of Hades, the gates of Hades, would prevail against it. You could go a step further into the personal, individual lives of believers and say, God has promised to not leave you or forsake you. So his faithfulness to you individually, to this local church, this local body right here in Queens, but to all the churches of the world, every local church meeting today on a Sunday, or whenever they meet, he is faithful to those people and those churches too. As we close our series of Mary's song, let's remember what we've learned. Her heart, all along in this song, was to magnify God. And she did that multiple ways. She put his goodness and glory on full display. She's described for us what God has done for her. And that's a beautiful thing, when you can stand up and say a personal testimony, this is how God has blessed me this week. Well, Mary's testimony, if she was in a church, would have been, hey, guess what I just found out? That would have been an amazing testimony service, no doubt. But it's not just for her. She's describing more than that. She's describing what God is going to do for victims of injustice and oppression. She tells us what God is going to do for the nation he chose for himself to be his special treasure. She has magnified the chief attributes of God: his strength, his holiness, his regard for the lowly and the humble, but also his faithful merciful, loving, covenant loyalty. And her song brings to mind all of these attributes. I'll close here this morning, the same way Mary does, by encouraging us to reflect on the faithfulness of God in the Christmas story. There's a lot of ways we could conclude because there's so many emphases in this one song. Sometimes songs can be so just one dynamic, and there's not a lot to it. But in this song, so many turns of the diamond, and you see all of its facets. It's a beautiful song. But what Mary wanted to highlight at the end, the last thing she wanted to leave in our minds, is that your God is faithful. He was faithful to Israel for all of its history, and he will continue to be faithful to it. He hasn't cast it off. For all 2,000 years of the church's history, since the first century until 2020, God has been faithful to his church. And you know what? He's going to be faithful to you, to your family, and to our church body this coming year. His faithfulness isn't a reward for your good behavior or my good behavior or because we have a successful ministry or because we're seeing a lot of people saved or any of that. His faithfulness is simply a natural expression of his love for you. And that's worth magnifying God for.